Hi, everyone. Welcome to the NJFP podcast. And this is two of our five series of podcasts about suicidal prevention. And today we are focused on firearm suicidal prevention. Then we will go over counseling the access to lethal means of safe fire storage, including the extreme risk protective orders, and also focus on high-risk group with access to firearms. And I am Dr. Karen Lin. I'm a family physician with Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. And here our speaker is Dr. Michael Anastas. We are very fortunate to have the specialist here. Dr. Anastas is associate professor, a licensed clinical psychologist. He is executive director of New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center at Rutgers School of Public Health. His work is focused on suicidal prevention among both civilian and service members, with a particular focus on the role of firearms. He is author of approximately 150 peer-reviewed articles, as well as a book, Guns and Suicide, and American Epidemics, which published in 2018. Dr. Anastas was also a 2018 recipient of the Edwin Scheidman Award. And currently he serves as advisory for many boards, and including American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and JET Foundation. So good day, Dr. Anastas.
Thank you for having me.
And so I guess our first part, we're going to talk about who is at risk and where the risk is.
Certainly. Where the risk is where the firearms are. So even before you get into specific groups, we know that death by suicide is more likely, 3 to 5 times more likely for everybody in the home if there's a firearm present compared to homes without a firearm, and that that risk goes up substantially if the firearm's stored unsafely. And I know we'll talk about safe storage and what that means quite a bit as the conversation goes on. But also, having said that, there are sort of particular demographic groups that have a sort of greater propensity to die by suicide using a firearm. And so if you're a clinician and you're trying to figure out where that risk is most likely to be housed, you could think about, you know, broadly speaking, men overall are more likely to die by suicide using a firearm than women. And that's particularly true for white men, and particularly for white middle-aged and older adult males. You can look at professions, whether that's service members and veterans, or law enforcement and other first responders, or folks who work in correctional settings. Honestly, it's largely folks who have had access to, exposure with, and comfort with highly lethal means, in this case, firearms.
Thank you. And as majority of our audience are probably family physicians, so that we do have responsibility to identify and to provide some advice to our patients. So that would you like to go over, there are certain project, for example, there's a governor's challenge to prevent suicidal among service members, veterans, and their families?
Certainly. So the governor's challenge is an initiative that has been going on for several years and in a number of states, and New Jersey has joined up this year. And it's not a firearm specific endeavor. It focuses on suicide prevention more broadly, and particularly for veterans and their family members. But the advice, I think, that comes out of the governor's challenge, I think, is relevant beyond veterans and their families, because the principles largely apply to everybody. And within the governor's challenge is embedded a lethal means subgroup that focuses really largely on firearms. But you talk about any method for suicide, and that's what I mean by lethal means, the method someone would use for suicide. But you know, obviously, in the case of suicide, the method we often talk about the most is fire.
Hello. I think we lost the connection a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, you froze.
Angie, yeah, froze for a little bit. So Angie, do you want him to repeat this part or?
Yeah, Mike, if you want to go back and start where you started explaining what the governor's challenge is. And yeah. Okay. And then I'll just cut the audio. No problem. Okay.
Sure. So the governor's challenge is an initiative that's been going on for several years in a number of states, and New Jersey has joined up this past year or so. And it's not a firearm specific endeavor. It's a suicide prevention initiative really focused primarily on veterans and their family members. But I think that the advice coming out of the governor's challenge is relevant beyond veterans. And so for the listeners of this podcast, I think that the info that the governor's challenge will provide is going to be super relevant. And within the governor's challenge, there is a sort of subgroup that focuses on lethal means or methods for suicide. And that conversation largely zeroes in on firearms. And my understanding is that one of the primary deliverables coming out of the governor's challenge will be a website that comes online before too long. And I don't have a URL for you available at this particular moment, but within that will be a number of free resources, including sort of tools and videos on ways to talk about firearms and suicide prevention, and sort of how to think about addressing this issue, both within it, but also beyond a clinical setting.
Definitely. And also during this 2 years of pandemic, we all know that the suicide rate has increased over different age groups. And the CDC also report there's a record number of gun numbers in 2020, but also is a near record number of gun suicide. Could you please comment on this?
Sure. So, you know, one of the good stories to come out of a pretty tumultuous couple of years is that the overall suicide rate has gone down, and that's different than what we'd seen for the previous, you know, 20 or so years, right? It's gone up every year since 2005 until 2019 that started to shift the other way. And you know, that's a whole other conversation about why in sort of tumultuous times, sometimes there's sort of a coming together effect where suicide rates go down. But I think it's important to note that that decrease was largely driven amongst white males where it went down. So not everybody saw a decrease. You saw an increase in the suicide rate amongst Black Americans. You saw a continued increase amongst service members and veterans. And in both these groups, you saw an increase in access to firearms and use of firearms and suicides. And so I think it's important to, you know, obviously when we think about the last couple of years, we think about the pandemic, but another thing that's worth noting in the context of this conversation, and as you mentioned, is that we've seen an unprecedented surge in firearm sales. And it's to emphasize what that means, that's not small stakes. Prior to this surge, there were already more firearms than there were people in this country. And so when you see a surge that by some estimates nationwide was a 40 to 60% increase in sales from 2019 to 2020, and within New Jersey, the state police said a 331 or 332% increase in permit requests, that's, we're talking millions of excess firearms in circulation. And so if you think back to that stat I mentioned at the very beginning, that suicide risk goes up 3 to 5 times when there's a firearm in the house, well, a lot more houses now have firearms in them, which means we have to think about risk a little bit differently.
Yeah, definitely. Even some of my patients, they never own a gun. And because there are so many things happening in the society that they attempt to obtain a gun, try to protect themselves. And so this concern for the home safety, how do you suggest that family physicians can have a successful conversation when the gun owners do want to hear about firearm safety?
Sure, and that's a difficult conversation to have, but I think not as difficult as a lot of us fear it will be. So the first thing is just to be aware of the sort of changing demographics and risk involved in firearm ownership. And so one of the sort of happy stats historically is that firearm access is not associated with thinking about suicide, right? So if you have a firearm owner and a non-firearm owner standing next to one another, the fact that one owns a firearm and one doesn't tells you nothing about who's most likely to think about suicide. But that's changed during this firearm surge, and that the folks who've purchased during this time period are more likely than other firearm owners and non-firearm owners to have had lifetime, past year, or even past month suicidal thoughts. And that's particularly true for first-time firearm owners. These folks who, like you mentioned, never owned a firearm before, but in the context of everything that's been going on, they bought one. And so that gets into your primary question here is that need for home safety. And one of the primary driving forces behind folks buying a firearm, particularly when they're buying it for the first time, is home protection. I want to keep myself, my loved ones safe. Having this item that to me feels like a tool will make us be okay should something horrific come to pass in our house and a sort of bad faith actor comes in and is armed, right? And so our conversations about firearm safety from the perspective of suicide prevention often involves telling folks to store a firearm or discussing with folks the idea of storing a firearm unloaded, separate from ammunition, in a secure lock location, like a gun safe or a lock box, ideally with a locking device like a trigger lock or a cable lock in place, and also having a plan in place to legally and temporarily store firearms away from home during times of stress. But if somebody owns a firearm for the purpose of home protection, all that advice that I just said is going to sound not just counterintuitive, it might sound dangerous, right? If I own this tool to keep myself and my loved ones safe in case of home invasion, and my physician says, no, make it really hard to access, that's going to feel like you're taking my need to keep us safe away, and you're putting myself and my loved ones in danger. And so I think it's really important if you want to have a successful conversation. And this is a nuanced conversation we could talk about for a while, but you need to be cognizant of the perspective of the person you're speaking with. You need to sort of step away from the desire to prescribe a specific set of steps someone has to take on how they store their firearm, because we quite frankly don't know which storage practices provide the most protection against suicide. And so your goal is to sort of walk alongside this individual, understand and validate their perspective, and find a path that they're comfortable with that they will then actually adopt that gets them at least a little bit safer. And I think that does a couple of things. One is it gets you, sort of moving in the right direction. But two, I think that it will in some ways surprise the person you're speaking with who might anticipate this being a sort of judgment-filled fight and instead finds, no, this was just someone who, like me, cares about safety and we're working collaboratively to find a way where I can be safe from suicide without losing the safety I feel the gun provides with respect to home invasion.
Yeah. Thank you. And somewhere the statistics say that New Jersey, the gun ownership is lowest in the nation. Is it true?
It's one of the lowest in the nation. We don't really have an official registry of firearm ownership nationwide, so it's hard to make true comparisons from state to state. But any sort of survey you get at, New Jersey is going to be down around the neighborhood of places like Massachusetts, where you're looking at somewhere in the vicinity of maybe 15% of your state as a firearm owner, as opposed to the 30 to 40% that you see nationwide. So yeah, firearm ownership is lower here. And unlike most of the country where more than half of suicide deaths are by firearm, in New Jersey, it's about 1 in 4. And that's in large part because there's so much less firearm access. It's not that firearm owners use firearms in suicide less frequently, it's that there's fewer firearm owners to use them in the first place.
And from time to time, unfortunately, we heard some sad news that children got hold of the firearms. And so how can we counsel the adult who have children at home?
Yeah, well, first of all, having children at home can be a point that you can leverage in those conversations with folks who own firearms for defensive purposes, by the way. So one of the ways we found to get around that obstacle is to get folks to say sort of, hey, what are some circumstances in which you think it might not make great sense for you or anyone else in your home to have ready access to that firearm? And a lot of times those conversations come back around to children and folks can get on board with that. It's easier to get folks to think about safe storage in the context of protecting someone else than protecting themselves, and particularly when it's children. And so that can be a point that a clinician can leverage. But I think that it's important to emphasize that you may encounter a lot of parents who think, no, my children don't know how to access it, or they know better than to access the firearm. But actually, there's a number of pretty startling studies out there that show that if you ask the parents and then you ask the kids, you find that not only do the kids know how to access a firearm, and not only have they accessed them before, they've accessed them pretty recently in a number of different times, right? So I think we as parents underestimate sometimes the extent to which our kids get in the middle of things. And so without, again, without yelling at a patient, without sort of, again, invalidating the perspective or blaming them for things, I think sometimes just helping them see things a little bit differently through a, again, collaborative conversation about what about these situations? Could you see a situation where it might make sense to try a gun safe or a lockbox, or you don't want to deal with a combination lock? How about a biometric lock that is specific to your fingerprint, allows a quicker access, but then your kids can't get to it no matter how hard they try? I think you might find a pretty sympathetic audience that is pleased to know that you're offering them a menu of options to consider.
Thank you. And so we heard there is this New Jersey Extreme Risk Protection Orders. Would you like to explain to our audience?
Sure. So Extreme Risk Protection Orders, some folks will call them ERPOs. You may have heard them called red flag laws. And you know, I tend to not be one to tell people how to say things or not. I would pause here for a second and say I'd encourage you to avoid the phrase red flag law, as for a number of reasons, but think of it this way. If people are going to interpret that as you're calling them a red flag, and I'm yet to meet someone who enjoys being characterized as such. So ERPO rolls off the tongue just as easily as red flag and doesn't have that connotation. And what these forms of legislation are, they differ from state to state. There's no current federal ERPO law in place, but the general structure is relatively similar wherever you're looking at. And they basically mean that certain stakeholders, in the case of New Jersey, members of the household or law enforcement, can petition a court in the case of imminent risk to self or other to remove access to firearms for some discrete period of time. And so, again, that there's a few things to keep in mind there. One is that this is not anybody can do it. It depends on the state you're in who can do this. Two, this isn't about stigmatizing mental illness. You don't issue an ERPO because someone's depressed or has been depressed. You issue an ERPO because there's evidence, behavioral evidence of imminent, immediate risk to someone else. And three, this is a last resort. This is not our primary tool for preventing suicide. It's what we do when we cannot find any other path towards creating a safer environment for that individual.
Thank you. Let's take a pause here. Angie, that I did not keep a record of how long our part one is. So do we still have time for the part one? Or do we want to move to part two?
Well, you got into the ERPA, so I didn't know if we wanted to focus more on that in part two, or did you want to just discuss it a little bit in part one?
The part two is like, what do we do that as a healthcare professional, that how we can help. So we do want to mention more of that in the part two. I just don't know. So you say each session is 15 minutes or 30 minutes?
It really doesn't matter. We go until we feel like we've covered the topic. I think we've got a good 20 minutes probably.
Okay.
Of recording time for part one. Do you feel, Mike, like you're ready to move into part two, or is there anything else you want to discuss for part one?
Yeah, no, I think I'm happy to go to part two. I think the only other thing is that, well, we talked about defensive ownership, so that kind of gets at it. I think the only other thing, and maybe this, I don't know if this goes in part one, part two, there are a couple of sort of general myths that I think are important to get past. Okay.
So why don't we go over the general myths and put that in part one? Do you think that's a good idea?
Sure, yeah. And if you want to even just ask, hey, are there any sort of myths that might sort of get in the way of this, I can then rattle off a couple and just a little bit of info about them. And that might be a nice way to wrap up part one.
All right. So Angie, it's up to you that we can start from here and just talk about myths. And then maybe Mike won't mind to repeat again to explain about the
ERPO.
Yeah, I'm happy to.
I would just give me a pause in between, like when you want to start part two, I just need long enough of a pause so that I can edit the audio. Okay.
So I think we were just going to ask about myths, and then Mike will give us a couple of examples. And then after that, we can have a pause.
Okay, sounds good.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, all right, that's restarted part one. Dr. Anastas, do you have any example to explain to our audience? Because we heard some myths about this.
Yeah, sure. I think that one of the most important myths to counteract, because it sounds very intuitive, is this idea that it doesn't make any sense to focus on preventing someone from using a specific method because they'll just find another way. And I think on a sort of basic level, that makes a lot of sense. It sounds reasonable. And if that were the case, that would raise some questions about this conversation, right? Because what's the value in changing how someone dies by suicide? We want to prevent someone from dying by suicide by any method, right? Firearm suicides aren't worse than other methods. They're just more common. And I think it's important to emphasize that that's not really how suicide tends to work. So first of all, the evidence shows that when you take the most lethal method frequently used in a specific geographic area and you either make it less deadly or less available, the overall suicide rate goes down. So for a couple of examples in the United Kingdom in the mid-20th century, the most common method for suicide was sticking your head in the oven, not because people were burning to death, but because they were suffocating. A level of carbon monoxide in domestic gas was so high that it was a quick and highly lethal method. And the UK government detoxified domestic gas, and the suicide rate by that method went down around 85 to 95%. The suicide rates by other methods stayed the same, which meant the overall suicide rate in the UK went down and stayed down by 30 to 40%. In Sri Lanka, they had a problem in the early 2000s with pesticides, and they banned a bunch of the most lethal brands, which is not an effective solution for firearms. You have to ban firearms in the US, but they did ban the more lethal brands of pesticide, and the overall suicide rate in Sri Lanka went down by 50%. And perhaps most relevant here is that in the Israeli Defense Force around that same time period, they noticed a lot of young service members during their compulsory military service were going home on weekend and holiday and killing themselves with their service weapons. And they just changed the policy and said, you have to check your firearm in the armory during holiday or weekend, and domestic or private firearm ownership is extremely rare in Israel. So they went home and they didn't die by other methods. They weren't dying as much. The overall suicide rate went down by 40%. So again, you see it pretty clear evidence, actually, people don't just find another way. But the second thing to consider that is, let's say you ignore all of that evidence and say, I still think they're going to find another way. There's one more factor that makes that myth worth getting past. And that's that whereas 2 to 3% of folks who intentionally overdose die by suicide, and less than 5% of all non-firearm suicide attempts result in death, 85 to 95% of all suicide attempts involving a firearm result in death. So even if somebody found another method, they're almost certain to find a less lethal method. And what's striking about that is 70% of folks who survive a suicide attempt never attempt again, right? So second chances matter a ton. But people who use this particular method because of its high case fatality rate don't get that second chance. So the intuitive myth, people will find another way, it makes sense, it's incorrect. But even if it was incorrect, it's not actually an obstacle to our argument, because finding another method will still probably save your life. And then the second myth that's worth talking about is that talking about the method is too far downstream. You should be focusing on why somebody wants to die in the first place. And I get that as a clinical psychologist, I've devoted a portion of my life to helping people feel better. That means quite a bit to me. And the issue here is that it's a false choice. Just like you can talk about drunk driving being a bad thing and not say you don't care about seatbelts or the speed limit, I can talk about the method being important without saying I don't care about depression or divorce or economic distress, right? All these things can exist in the same space. And the reality is suicide prevention is focused almost exclusively on making people feel better for the last 70 years. And the data shows we've gotten no better at prospectively predicting who's going to die by suicide. We're not good at understanding what that risk is. So in order to give them a chance to feel better, I first need to make sure they're alive. And so my focus on the method isn't dismissing the importance of understanding why someone's miserable. It's giving us a chance to understand why they're miserable by making their environment less sort of favorable towards death by suicide.
Thank you for your advice.